This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Good frights and good bone marrow to everyone out there. This is Junk Food Cinema, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good. It is frightening.
Oh, God. Thank God. October's almost fucking over.
So many puns. Like, the entire Halloween industry is built upon puns. Like, it's the Halloween industry followed by the porn industry, followed by
the direct-to-DVD horror industry.
Exactly. And The Asylum is third on that list behind porn, where it fucking should be.
Right.
This is, of course, like I said, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast here on filmschoolrejects.com. I am Brian Salisbury. He is C. Robert Cargill.
Together we are the Wonder Twins. Activate.
Obscure cinema powers. Activate.
Form of a shitty 90s B-movie.
Form of McCready's bottle of scotch.
God bless. Except
God bless McCready.
It's Jameson's. But
yeah, but
you
when,
know
you're
what?
In,
still,
when you're in Antarctica, you drink
Jameson,
whatever.
Look, that is probably the least believable part in that movie, that he's actually got a bottle of Jameson's in Antarctica.
See, why is there no like extensive fan theory about that bottle of Jameson? Maybe the bottle of Jameson was the thing. Did you see it breathing? I rest my case. And if you want to hear more delusional theories like that, you can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like us, if you're just head over heels in love with what we do week after week, I would invite you to go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and become a patron of the show.
So you can get even more of our bullshit.
You can get so much of our bullshit. And if you would like to feed a little bit of that bullshit back to me, Brian Salisbury, we are only $18 away from our super flex goal. And if we hit that, our goal of $300 per episode, if we hit that, the taste test becomes a real thing where you, patrons, can send me, Brian, any movie that you want me to watch and review.
Any piece of shit.
Any movie. And I will have to sit down, watch said piece of shit, as long as you can provide me either a DVD copy or a link to where I can watch it. And then I have to fucking review it. It is, what did we call it last week? The Cinematic Rochambeau?
Cinematic Rochambeau.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going to happen. $18 from now! So get on patreon.com/junkfoodcinema if you haven't already. Or if you have already, help spread the word so that we get to that goal.
Or just hang and listen to us, because we love that too.
That too.
Like, I don't think we do give our junkions a lot of love, but we also got to give love to all of you who listen, who keep the podcast alive. Like,
for sure.
Is just the very fact that you guys, we need you guys for this not to be two guys in my living room fucking jerking each other off.
Okay. Two guys in your living room fucking, and then I was like, oh, he means he's going to segue into some other activity, and she's using fucking as a lead-in.
And then I jumped into jerking each other off.
So
because that's how we did
it. Was more of a lateral move than I expected.
It was more of a metaphor, but then you made it weird, and you won't break eye contact with me right now, so I'm a little even more weirded out.
That's what meta's for. By the way, we are still in the throes of the Festival of Fear.
The Festival of Fear.
Festival of Fear.
I feel like we should have like one of those 80s radio effects for that, where we're just like, the Festival of Fear.
Have you not been listening? Because I totally made a jingle for it.
Oh, did you?
I did. And the jingle is one part Vincent Price's laugh from the end of Thriller, and two parts Goosebumps TV show theme song.
I've been a little preoccupied this month, so I haven't
What's going on, Cargill? Tell us.
I am working on a book, I guess, maybe.
Wait, what?
Oh! You mean the movie?
I
also have a movie coming out, and yeah, there's been, you know,
it's
that
called
stuff.
Doctor T and the Women?
Dr. Mordred 2,
yes.
Back in Hollywood. Deeper into Mordred. I forget what the tagline we settled on. My little indie film, Doctor Strange.
Yes.
Just opened in the UK. For those UK listeners, please, for the love of God, go see that movie. I say the UK, it's also apparently all throughout Europe. People in Germany have been contacting me because we have German junkies, which makes me so happy. Hello, Germany.
Das Junkions.
Yeah. The movie's coming out. It's rolling out. It comes out in Hong Kong. By the time you've heard this, it's already out.
I did not know that.
And yeah, Hong Kong, I believe, was and China was the 27th. And then, of course, then the U.S. on November 4th. And please, I would love it if you went out and supported the movie. We're really proud of it. People seem to like it. Yeah.
And if you like that movie, make sure you tell your friends to listen to this podcast, because we have one of the writers as a co-host. And if you don't like that movie, tell your friends to listen to this podcast, because we have a lieutenant of Megaforce as a co-host. So either way you slice it. But yes, getting back to the Festival of Fear, we are doing our grand finale.
The Festival of Fear.
DJ Dracula. We are in our finale.
We need to have Nuke on the show at some point. Like not the lead singer of Kiss, have Nuke on the show from Trick or Treat.
Oh, yes. We absolutely need to get Gene Simmons in here to do a little bit of
Nuke.
Some drops, just some quick drops.
The likable Gene Simmons. We're never getting to this movie, I assure you.
No, we are not getting to this movie, which is...
Did we mention that we're drinking scotch tonight? Because we're totally drinking scotch tonight.
We might be drinking scotch tonight. This show might get a little off the rails. If you listen to the end of the last episode, picture that for an hour.
And we're already off the rails.
Yeah. This movie we're talking about, which is a film we saw at, I believe it was...
Fantastic Fest.
Fantastic Fest 2008, I believe.
We're talking like this played, I want to say this is 2006, because this was part of...
I saw it at Fantastic Fest. It was the very first one I went to, I believe, which would have been...
6 or 7.
Yeah.
Because wherever it was you showed up, your first year was the year of the Spanish invasion.
It was.
And the Spanish invasion was this amazing thing where we just had a bunch of Spanish filmmakers...
Not to be confused with the Spanish Inquisition.
No, because nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. No one also expected the Spanish invasion. Essentially, what happened was... People in Spain had suddenly become very interested in filmmaking, and the very first film school opened, and a bunch of Spaniards went to film school together, and they all graduated in 2003 and 2004 and said, we're going to go off and make our own movies. And this year, this weird year, all these guys showed up to Fantastic Fest with names like Nacho Vigalondo and Juan Bayona and what was the name of the guy who did Backwoods?
Oh my God, Backwoods was so good.
Backwoods played, but we literally have this year where we've got Chronos Criminis, aka Time Crimes, which those everyone with Netflix has hopefully seen by now. If you are listening to our show and you haven't watched Time Crimes, watch it, because it's such a classic of modern genre. We have not covered it yet.
Yes.
It plays with the same year as The Orphanage. It plays with the same year as this great movie, Backwoods, that we should probably do a month on the Spanish invasion at some point.
Yeah.
Because there's a couple films in it that we need to talk about. We get this great film which introduced me to you, called La Hora Fria.
The Cold Hour.
The Cold Hour, yes. Which was the movie that I introed at the beginning, and you and your buddy at the time were like, all right, this guy's really excited. We're watching this movie, and you guys loved as much as I loved and came out and insisted on buying me a beer. And there's a photo on our Facebook feed of the very first time we met and had a beer together.
Holy shit, Twilight Zone moment. You know what I just realized about that photo? I am wearing the shirt I am wearing right now.
That does not surprise me.
Q-Rod Serling.
Yeah, no.
DJ Serling.
Like, literally, that movie. Like, so this year we had four major talents emerge, four major, like, big hits of Fantastic Fest happened, and one of them produced by Guillermo del Toro. And that is tonight's movie, La Orphanette, a.k.a. The Orphanage.
Disappearance. A dark place. And the games children play. The Orphanage.
Now, The Orphanage is a movie that I saw and completely blew me away as a, you know, I think I was 23. I was completely bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and it just completely knocked me through the back of the theater. This is a movie that, like you were saying, part of that Spanish invasion that is I watched it again today, and something really jumped out at me. This, and I don't use this word very often, I think this may be a flawless movie. Like, every single bit of the execution of this, every moment of character development, all of the things that are sewn at the beginning and the way they pay off at the end, and I cried again at that ending. Like, I cannot find a fault with this movie. It is one of those movies that is so beautiful to me that it not only kind of defies the expectations of what most people think a horror movie is, but it also proves the worth and the potential of the genre.
Well, yeah, and but more to the point, it proves the worth and the amazingness of Bayona. This is Bayona's first feature.
This is his
first feature.
Right out of the gate.
And it is better than many of the things that have come since, and I would say on par with his new movie, which we will eventually talk about, A Monster Calls, which I find equally as brilliant as The Orphanage. So if that tickles your funny bone out there, folks.
That's the one about the babysitter who starts getting calls from a monster and they're coming from underneath the bed.
No, it's not about that 17-year-old girl who has a restraining order on you. This is a movie where Liam Neeson voices a monster in a kid's imagination that may or may not be his imagination.
Fuck yes.
And it is such a good movie. It is so going back to his roots. It's part of what inspired this, I'm certain, because we're like, fuck yeah, Bayona's fucking brilliant. We haven't covered The Orphanage yet. And
I cannot believe we haven't covered this movie yet.
You know, it's one of those movies that I feel like it straddles the line that we kind of dip over sometimes. It confuses people because most of the time we're like, hey, here's this crazy German film that you guys need to check out. And people are like, holy fuck, I've never heard of this and I needed this in my life. I've gotten so many great messages from those of you folks that watched Dare Samurai this week. I'm so glad I got to turn you guys onto that. But I feel like this is one of those movies where I know that it was good. It was such a success that it was going to be remade over here. I know that in 2009, Scott Derrickson, my co-writer and director, was in the running for it, but it never came together. And it's one of those movies that, because it's such a flawless film, it's one of those movies that people are like, of course I've seen The Orphanage. I know The Orphanage. But then when you mentioned it, I looked it up. And the only way to stream it is in SD.
Yeah. The only way to stream it in the proper audio, is in SD. I actually rented it through the PlayStation Store, which, by the way, little sidetrack here, Sony. What is the point of calling something a 30-day rental if after the first time you watched it, it disappears 24 hours later? That's not a fucking 30-day rent.
Well, it's the same way with that Amazon works.
That's bullshit.
You rent it, and then you have 30 days to watch it, and then every movie has a... But see, the thing is what I did and what I would recommend many of you do, if you have not seen this, you need to watch this. Like, absolutely. It has to happen. But the rental on Amazon is $2.99, but to buy it is $5.99.
Just fucking buy it.
Yeah, it's SD, but I bought it, and my wife was like, yay, we own this. Because this is the movie, literally, every year, my wife asks me to watch this movie. And she acts like she has to twist my arm to fucking watch this movie, which she does not. But she always wants to watch it, and so I always watch it with her. And then I guess, I'm like, yeah, sure, I guess we'll do it. And I say it in such a way that she thinks that she then owes me to watch whatever I want to watch, and lets me pull off things like I did the other night where she's like, all right, you pick a movie. I said, I don't think you've ever seen Maximum Overdrive. She's like, I hear that's not great. I'm like, you have no idea. And everyone we've run into for the past 2 days is the first things out of her mouth is, oh my God, have you ever seen Maximum Overdrive?
So that answers the question, who made who watch Maximum
Overdrive? Who made who which? And she did not regret it. Like,
God, I love that movie.
So do I. But one of these days we are owed a full episode on Maximum Overdrive.
I agree.
But this is that movie that my wife every year wants to watch at Halloween, and for good reason. But much like in another wonderful juxtaposition, if you will, and another wonderful coincidence, you picked two movies this month. I picked two movies this month. Yours has an interesting connection as well, because you picked Housebound and The Orphanage.
I picked Haunted House movies.
Yeah, but you also picked two movies that play very differently the first time from the second time.
This is true. This is very true.
The Orphanage plays as a horror film the first time and as a fairy tale the second time.
The whole first act of this movie is a masterclass on elegantly sowing narrative seeds.
Yes.
It's casting foreshadows all over this dark house.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's dropping more breadcrumbs than an Edgar Wright
flick. Stop it.
Hype man. DJ Hype Man.
Owen Edgerton is going to have a lock on Fantastic Debates for a long time. You are not wrestling that from him.
I'm just saying. It's one of those movies where everything in the first act means something different by the time you really get into the meat of the story. And speaking of the story, let's kind of break down the plot a little bit. We open on a group of orphans playing a game called Knock on the Wall. Now, if you aren't familiar, orphans are the hilariously parentless cast-offs of society that... Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was supposed to explain the game. It's a lot like Red Light, Green Light, where basically you say 1, 2, 3, knock on the wall. When you're facing the wall, then you turn around, and people who have been trying to run up to tag you have to freeze or they're out. So it's a lot like Red Light, Green Light. So that's how we open, and then...
But as we learn...
Yes.
Through this brilliant opening shot, these kids are not normal.
No, there's something a bit... It's kind of like that Tim Burton movie that just came out. They're a little peculiar, although none of them have superpowers.
Wow. Yeah, no, instead of superpowers, they're all sick and dying orphans.
Well,
or
yeah,
kids
kind of
with
superpowers.
With, you know, braces on their legs,
hey,
or
they
deformities.
Can from the earth very quickly in their young lives
and not be noticed, gone.
Yeah, they're invisible and they disappear from the earth. Those are superpowers.
You are so going dark this week, my friend.
I thought it was funny. But from there we find out we jump ahead to many years later, and we meet this family living in what appears to be the same house that we saw at the beginning of the movie, and they are in the process of opening up an orphanage for...
Kind of, except they aren't.
It's basically...
It's a home.
It's a home for children with special needs, and they're looking to basically take in about 5 or 6, a very small group, and they're trying to, you know, get the house finished, get all the appropriate paper signed and authorizations and so forth, and then start accepting applicants. And the two of them have themselves adopted a child named Simone, who
we don't actually know is adopted until later in the first act. Yeah.
Spoiler alert, we're going to spoil this movie too. So definitely
this is, of course, the point that if for some reason you have not watched The Orphanage, for the love of God, pause it.
Yeah.
Come back to us later. Watch The Orphanage immediately. Weep. See this magnificent movie. Question your life choices because you've allowed this movie to exist in the world for almost a decade and not had it part of your life.
Yeah.
And then come back and listen to us drink scotch and continue to talk about this.
Yes. Brought to you by DJ Spoiler and MC Ruins a Film. So, yes, definitely watch it before we speak any further on this. But what we find out is that their own child, Simone, is HIV positive, and
VIH.
Wow. Do.
No, that was the weirdest thing. It's like, because the thing is like, you know, and you see it, and it's VIH, and it's,
oh, that's right, yeah.
Because and I was like, VI. Oh yes, because the language, the words work differently, but it's the
flippity
same
floppy.
Acronym.
Flippity floppity. And so he has started to talk to his adoptive parents about these invisible friends of his and the games that they play. And one of the games that they play is basically where the invisible friends will steal one of his treasures and then leave a series of clues as to how he can find it again.
Now, this kid, Simone, has had these two imaginary friends for a long time, so this is not weird to them.
Well, and, you know, when you're a child diagnosed with HIV, as it turns out, ghosts are the least of your worries and are actually a welcomed arrival in the house. So already kind of an interesting turn for this film. But they live in this house that's on the beach, and there's a certain cave on the beach that at every high tide basically completely fills up with water. And at one point during the film, Simone goes missing. The mother is frantically trying to find him and thinks she sees him in this cave, and presumes at first that he has drowned. There's a little bit of a is he there? Isn't he there? But the bottom line is he's missing, and she is desperately trying to find him, and then becomes convinced that perhaps the invisible friends in the house not only had something to do with his disappearance, but can help her recover Simone. And that's kind of where the story takes its supernatural turn.
And here is the important piece of information, is that, of course, this woman lived in this house as an orphan and was adopted out of this house, which is why she's trying to get back here. And what is brilliant about this film is how it, as you said, how it lays all these narrative seeds. And it tells you two different stories. It tells you the story you think you're watching the first time, which is a haunted house story. But instead, it's telling you a fairy tale. And it's telling you this fairy tale and weaving these two together to where you only see one the first time, and the second time you cannot see the other. You cannot, every time you watch this movie again, you will never be able to see the haunted house movie again, because it's one of those things that dialogue you discount the first time around becomes really important. And this is what I'm going to bring up about the first act. When Simone reveals the game that these kids play, where they take a treasure, but they leave a clue, and you track the clues down, and he teaches us how to play this game. And when he wins the game, which he does do in the first act, he says, "I get my wish. I get my wish."
Yeah.
And that gets blown off because it's just an excited kid playing a game. And you, as the audience, are so fascinated with the idea of these ghosts doing this that you're worried about what they're luring him into and not realizing that it's all true. Simone has one wish, and he has laid it out for us subtly. And as it also turns out, our protagonist, the mother, has one wish, which she says directly. And then she plays the game later in the movie and wins the game. And the rest of the movie is about setting up her wish and giving her everything she ever wanted. And that is what I think is so beautiful about this fucking movie, is that it is a fairy tale, very much in the vein of Pan's Labyrinth, but without the ending of Pan's Labyrinth that kind of robs you of the satisfaction of knowing one way or the other. Like, I think, I believe that Pan's Labyrinth is an amazing movie. I absolutely love it, but I feel like the ambiguous ending keeps people from having the true satisfaction and love with that movie that I think it could have. I think that if he had chosen one ending or the other, it would be one of the most brilliant movies ever made. And instead, it's just a really brilliant movie.
Wait, this one?
No, Pan's Labyrinth.
Oh, I was okay. I was going to say
Pan's Labyrinth.
All right.
This movie, on the other hand, gives you a very similar ending to Pan's Labyrinth, but shies away from the ambiguous ending and gives you a very deliberate ending that recontextualizes the movie after you watch it the first time. And every time after that becomes this beautiful, elegantly told fairy tale. Like, I mean, that's the only thing, because it's not a ghost story. Like it is very tied. It is more tied into the wishes than it is tied into the ghosts that appear in this film. And I am hypnotized by that, because it layers on everything. There's a movie that we're going to talk about in our Patreon thing this week that this movie borrows from, borrows heavily from, and does so eloquently. Like, this movie steals an entire sequence from it, from The Changeling.
Oh, yeah. It's so, I have in my notes something very specific about The Changeling that I'm going to get to, so I'm really glad you brought that up.
Because, yeah, because, spoiler alert, we're going to talk about our favorite Halloween films, and one of my favorite Halloween films is The Changeling, and if you've ever read anything I've ever written about Halloween, you've heard me talk about The Changeling ad nauseum.
Yeah.
So, yeah, spoiler alert, Changeling's going to be on the list. This movie borrows a whole sequence from it, but does it so well, and does some really fresh stuff with it that it just nails it.
Yeah.
And it's so great. But yeah, this is the thing that fascinates me about The Orphanage, is it is more Pan's Labyrinth than it is The Changeling, but it doesn't get regarded that way.
No. And that's what's crazy, is it is one of the most beautiful movies I have ever seen. And I mean that in terms of visual aesthetics, in terms of heartfelt performances, and in terms of, God, that ending that will absolutely fucking pulverize.
Oh, yeah.
What I really like about this movie is it does play with a lot of the tropes of a haunted house movie.
Yes.
Right down to the fact that very early in the movie, we get a visit from the creepy old woman Harbinger type character.
Oh, yeah.
Who, by the way, she comes in for an interview basically to talk about Simone. It's a little dubious of what agency she's representing. Why are you really here? And then later in the movie, our heroine goes out to the shed. And I have seen some shit in horror movies. I have seen the cat fake scare before. I have seen the doorbell fake scare, the boyfriend behind the fridge door fake scare. But shovel-wielding old lady fake scare? Bravo. Bravo, because it's just the scene where she's panning around this room, and it's not like she jumps out. She's just standing there with a shovel, and it's like, well, time to leave, excuse me. And you're like, what the fuck is going on? And then we see this woman again later in one of the most bone-chilling moments of the whole film. We see her again, and this is more of a horror
movie.
Is this
on the street?
Yes.
Yes. This is a moment, again, you know, how Bayona takes classic moments, and this is what great directors do, and I will tell you this, having interacted with a number of great directors, working with a great director, one of the things that great directors do is they see a brilliant moment and they're like, I want to put this moment in my movie, but how do I hide it?
Yeah.
How do I conceal it? How do I make it something different? And how do I do it in a way that, you know, that hits the exact moment? And there's a moment, the scene where the old woman gets run down. It is the bus moment from Final Destination.
That's so funny. When you were talking, like, building it, like, great directors, great movies, great moments, I wanted to make a joke that you were referring to Final Destination because I thought you were referring to a better movie than that.
Oh, no, no.
But I love the fact that that's exactly what you were referring to.
No, because the thing is, the bus moment from Final Destination became parlance in Hollywood. When you talk to Hollywood producers about making a horror movie, invariably you will hear in a meeting, we're looking for like the bus moment from Final Destination. Like that is part of the parlance because it's like, we want to watch somebody get clobbered and killed out of nowhere unexpectedly and make the audience jump and have that moment fuck them. That is a thing that is very much part of the industry now. And that is very much the bus moment.
Yeah.
But done in such a great way.
I want to propose to you an idea for a book that I think we need to write, Cargill, called The Pitchinary, which is basically the urban dictionary for Hollywood, where if you want to pitch a movie, here are some of the terms and parlance that you need to know, like bus moment, save the cat, you know, all of these.
I would do that, but the problem is that within 60 days, if you used those phrases, no one would take you seriously anymore. So I would ruin.
You think people a generation from now will take people who say fleek seriously? Because I don't.
Well,
but it's still in the urban dictionary.
There are certain things like it once they become overly popularized, it becomes cliche and passe, and somebody's just pitching us something they read out of a book.
Otherwise,
I'm with you.
I'm adding to my book. What the term for when you're trying to pitch a book of pitches and it's not going well.
It's not going
and
well.
And we need to figure that out. But yes, when this old woman gets clobbered by a passing van, it is the effect of, like, because you, it's so brilliant the way they do this, because at first you think they're not going to show anything because there's a shot of someone administering CPR, but it's very.
And he comes up and he's covered in blood.
But it's very, you know, ankle height and above, and she's lying on the ground, so you don't see her, and you think, well, this is a classy movie. They're obviously. And then before you can even process that whole sentence, there is this mangled jaw. Ugh, it is vertical to her face, it is fucked up and a half. And it's something out of like Dead Alive for just a moment.
Yeah.
And you are freaked out just seeing it. And then she fucking moves. Why is that moving? That should be dead. I say that, not she, because at this point it is inhuman. That should be dead. Kill it with fire. But yeah, it still haunts my dreams to this day.
And another weird structural thing. She's actually the villain of the movie.
Yes.
And she dies very early on into the mystery.
Yes. Oh,
my God.
She's
the movie's villain.
She is. And that's, I love, and this, I love the subgenre of supernatural mystery horror films. Things like Stir of Echoes, where it's like, yeah, there's something supernatural going on, but in the meantime, you are trying to solve, you know, a mystery. Like, there's something in the human world that needs to be sussed out so that, you know, the appropriate agents can be punished and so on and so forth. But yeah, it's actually, and that's why this movie, and it cannot be an accident considering who its producer is and the amount of kids and like living kids interacting with ghost kids. So much Devil's Backbone in this movie.
Oh yeah,
so much Devil's Backbone, which, well, if you haven't seen, is amazing.
I met Juan Bayona back when he brought this movie, when he's this fresh-faced kid from Spain, really excited to be in a room with these film critics he's been reading. So it was like, it's been interesting to watch him go from being that excited kid, like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm in a room with you guys, to becoming the Juan Bayona who doesn't even go to film festivals anymore for the premieres of his movies because he's just, you know, a reclusive, you know, filmmaker who, you know, just doesn't deal with the press and just makes great movies.
Yeah.
But he was a huge Del Toro fan. So when Del Toro loved a short of his and said, I want to produce whatever you've got, what do you have? And he gave him the script for The Orphanage, and Guillermo got behind it. He geeked the fuck out. And he's like, oh my God, like, you have no idea. I'm such a fan of Devil's Backbone, and Devil's Backbone was a big inspiration for this. Mm-hmm. So this was
Okay, well, there you go.
Oh yeah, no. So I mean, this is Juan Bayona, who you know, as a young film student, writing a script that is very much rooted in this movie that he loved by one of his hero filmmakers, mm-hmm. at the time, also a young, you know, punk on the scene who not everyone got yet, because nobody, you know, Devil's Backbone's a movie a lot of people went back to. Like, it was not a film that was on too many people's radar. Like, you know, he had screenings here in Austin, and it was one of those things where not everybody knew who Guillermo del Toro was at the time and didn't realize how much potential he had. And so here's this guy that loved this guy, you know, from the beginning and was idolizing him. And then he came in and said, yeah, I'll help you get this produced. I'll stand by it. I think The Orphanage is better than The Devil's Backbone. I love The Devil's Backbone. Devil's Backbone.
I totally 100% agree. And I love the fact that, like you said, repeat viewings. This movie pays dividends on those repeat viewings.
Yeah.
Right from the title sequence. Because the title sequence with, you know, you're seeing these ultra...
The tearing wallpaper.
And you're seeing these ultra close-up textures of wallpaper. I mean, you're seeing, like, little kid hands ripping the wallpaper away, and then it cuts back into close-up where you're seeing every fiber as it's ripped from the wall. I mean, I think the cinematographer was Gil Grissom from CSI, because they are going like full into detail on that paper. And it's like, no, seriously, look really closely at this wallpaper and look really closely at what's going on, because there's shit hiding underneath. Like, so even when you rewatch it, the title sequence is trying to clue you in that there's something bigger going on. And what I think is the most fascinating and the most moving section of this movie is when our heroine basically makes the decision that she's going to be in this house for 2 days by herself before she and her husband, who have started having difficulties because, you know, after her son goes missing, she's, you know, withdrawing, and she's starting to believe more and more in the supernatural. I mean, they call in mediums. By the way, chicken, eggs, don't know. There's a lot of stuff in this that also reminds me of The Conjuring and Insidious. And, like, I don't know if it's just because...
Those came later.
They did, but that's what... But what I'm saying is, I don't know if James Wan saw this and was inspired by this, or if James Wan and Bayona just saw the same movies.
Oh, I think it's Wan and Bayona saw the same movies. Like, there's
that
nothing...
That seance scene, it just so... And, like, all of the green light that they were using, and the specificity of, you know, the crew that they bring in, that, I'm sorry, that woman might as well have been Lynn Shay that comes into the house.
Well,
with her,
yeah,
crew
except that this is also exactly how the crew was in The Changeling.
Changeling, yeah.
Like, Changeling definitely has that sequence, like, right down to the reel-to-reels they're using. Like, and that's one of the things I love about this is the ephemera. Like, this is one of those movies that I didn't realize until rewatching it this time that this might have had just a hair of influence on the visuals in terms of what I had in my head for Sinister.
Oh, I'm going to get to that.
Because the idea from Sinister already existed and existed with Super 8 footage. Yeah. Like that it was already in my head. That was an idea that came from a nightmare I had. So that didn't come from it. But the way they use 8mm film in this movie, the way they use the reel-to-reels mm-hmm. and the video, and that whole sequence is done so elegantly and so masterfully, that it is, I can't deny its influence in how the idea evolved in my head before I made my final pitch to Scott and got that movie made.
That was not a Jacques Hughes plagiarism type thing. I made a very different connection between this movie and Sinister.
Okay.
That is based upon something that Bayona himself said at that screening. So I'll get to that in just a minute.
I'm very curious to hear that.
But so this seance scene, I was going somewhere else, but I got derailed by this seance scene because that moment makes the hairs on every part of me stand up.
Yeah.
Because this woman is basically put into a trance. With something I actually haven't seen in any other horror movie of this type, is they use strobing light to put her into a trance. I've never seen that in any other supernatural haunted house movie before.
Yeah. Also, a weird connection is how they describe the seance. The only other movie I could connect it to in terms of concept would be The Innkeepers.
Because
there's the moment where they go, you know, she goes into a trance where she sees the house at a bridge point between the past, the present, and the future. Mm-hmm. And The Innkeepers is the only movie I know that does that, that connects all of those things together in one point to what haunting is. And it presents this idea that the echoes... You know, it talks about an idea that's been around for a long time, the idea that if something tragic happens in a house, in a place, that it essentially sends out emotional echoes. It leaves a little piece of itself behind. But how we do it, how we contextualize it, and how it exists in most horror, almost the entirety of horror, is the echoes go out in one direction, in the direction that time is going, so that we existing in time are hearing the echoes of this thing that happened ages ago. And that's what ghosts are. That's what, you know, certain levels of phantasmal energy comes from. But there's also this idea that it can be going the other direction, that it's going against the flow of time, that it actually happens, that this emotional event, you know, that we are experiencing time at a certain place, and time is happening all around the universe all at once. And so things that are happening from the future are coming back in echoes in the other way. And this is one of those rare movies. It doesn't do much with it, but it presents that idea, and I'm fascinated by that idea. Innkeepers is the one movie that really does anything with it. But it's so fascinating to see Bayona playing around with the idea that time and horror is transportable, and that maybe some of these things that this woman experiences in this trance are things from the end of the movie as well.
Yeah. Yeah. The tachyons are just flying everywhere. The tachyons and the PKE, there's so much residue in this house. And that just her walking.
This is from the year 1999.
Oh my God.
Receiving this transmission.
God, how fucking creepy is that, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then you walk into that building and it's like, oh, hello, Mr. Trump. So she's walking around this topical. She walks around this DJ topical. She walks around this house and she gets to the room.
Yeah, we walked in and he grabbed you by the arm.
Hey-oh. Grab her by the poltergeist. She walks, you start to hear the like through their electronic equipment, you start to hear voices, children's voices, and then you hear this just horribly unsettling, otherworldly crying. She gets to this room and she's like, you know, open the door. And they're like, we want you to open the door. Someone's trying to kill us. And she opens it and you don't see what she's seeing, but her reaction and the sound work is like enough to give you nightmares for years. And it is absolutely amazing. But God, I don't even remember where I was going before I got derailed by the seance, because that scene just really... Oh, the cinematography in this movie is so immaculate that there's one shot earlier in the film where she's the, our heroine is wheeling around in a wheelchair because she's broken her leg, and it's a top down shot of her going from one room into the hallway and then up and down the hallway. So it's like, you know, if you ever played the original Grand Theft Auto, kind of that view. But it was so beautiful to look at. I mean, it's the cinematography is so good. It's decadent to witness. It's like it's the death by chocolate of shot composition. And that shot in that creepy house had me salivating at the idea of a Bayona-directed Changeling remake. If they're going to remake The Changeling, I would fucking love, which is why I'm glad you brought up The Changeling, I would love to see Bayona take that on.
Yeah, nobody can remake The Changeling.
No, and I agree with you.
No. That's not an opinion.
That is a line in the fucking sand is what that is.
No, it's a fact.
Oh, it's like...
You do know that I was supposed to remake The Changeling at some point.
This is why the Pictionary needs to be a thing, Cargill, so that people can be like, Changeling, a movie that cannot, for legal reasons, be remade.
That is exactly it.
Okay, should be in the pitch. I'm adding it right now. Edit. Pictionary.
No. Like, Changeling. Literally, there's like somebody... I don't know the whole story, except that somebody who has the rights to it is in jail for fraud, and as a result is legally not able to sign the paperwork that he needs to sign to get all the to get the rights released, so nobody can actually make the movie.
Wow.
Like, we were supposed to, because that was the problem that Guillermo had getting the movie off the ground, and Guillermo left, and they, after, as Sinister had not come out yet, but people had heard rumblings of it, and they're like, oh, there's this team that would be perfect for this, and they brought us into, and we literally sat around for 2.5 months trying to get this movie made. Damn. And then found out, oh yeah, by the way, there's this guy who can't sign the paperwork we need signed, so we're very sorry we've kept you sitting around for 2.5 months. Like, yeah, no, a Bayona would be a perfect choice for The Changeling. Like, he would, like, that is a perfect, because The Changeling is also one of those movies that is a terrifying ghost story, but is actually a beautiful tragedy.
Yes, and that's,
and it's about two tragedies coming together.
And that's what this movie
is. That's what this movie is. And so I feel like this really is a kindred spirit to The Changeling.
And speaking of spirits, I remember where I was going with this is, after the seance, you get the impression that our heroine is even more convinced that these children, these ghost children, know where Simone is. It's part of this game that they want to play. And her husband is convinced that these are just con artists, and their relationship is fractured. And he's like, we need to move. And she goes, just give me 2 days to be in this house by myself to grieve. And she basically sets up an elaborate cosplay situation where she's trying to recreate, because she finds out by this point that all of the kids she was with in the orphanage, she finds out that they died.
Yeah.
And
they were poisoned.
They were poisoned.
And they were poisoned by this woman who at this point in the movie is already dead.
She has been flattened by a van. And so she finds this out because she heads out to the shed and discovers a three-faced giant kiln. Okay, word to the wise. If you buy a house and it has a shed with a three-faced kiln, bodies got burned in that thing. There is no other practical application for an oven that big than charring up some evidence, because...
Or making really large fucking pizzas.
So unless you bought a brick oven pizza franchise in a haunted house... Look, I happen to know for a fact that
you once drove an hour and a half to eat a pizza the size of a table.
I did, but you know what? It wasn't at someone's fucking house. It was at a restaurant.
Look, if you need to cook lots of food for, you know, tiny little very ill children...
Yeah.
And then have a place to dispose of said little tiny children...
What a horrific moment, right? The discovery of those burned up little bambinos.
And she's just pouring
baby
it out,
skeleton.
And she falls into the ground, and she's just covered with the ashes of her friends who she grew up with.
She's just sitting there freaking out, and her face is all, like, lightly dusted with her childhood friends. What the shit? And this is where this character shines for me, is that despite that, she is one of the bravest characters I have ever fucking seen, because not only does she continue with, I'm going to try and contact these what I now know to be my dead friends from childhood, but the moment where she plays the game, when she plays Knock on the Wall, the third time she turns around and there is a ghost standing there, the bravest thing that she fucking does in this whole movie is when she turns back around and does it. If you turn and you look, and facing you on the other side of the room is a ghost, and you have the cajon to turn your back on that fucking ghost, you are operating on a level of courage I can't even fathom.
But again, this plays into what this movie actually is. Mm-hmm. And when we get to the end of talking about all this, I want to lay out the other movie, because the other movie is fascinating.
Yeah.
Because the exploration of this haunted house and the exploration of connecting with these ghosts and the search for Simone is a great movie.
Absolutely.
The movie underneath is so much better.
When you peel that wallpaper away and find the movie underneath, it is a pretty spectacular moment. And we can actually jump right into that. The only other thing I wanted to mention is that the score for this movie. I mean, you want to talk about someone who in Bayona is inspired by the classics. The composer that he chose and the score that composer put together sounds, it is, especially during that seance scene and then in this final act that we're talking about, it is wonderfully old-fashioned. It is like specifically old Hollywood suspense. It's like
very Hitchcockian.
Yes, it's a lesser Bernard Herrmann, yeah. Which is to say still a slightly better Danny Elfman. So it really... Ooh, I'm sorry. Danny Elfman, his whole career has just wanted to be Bernard Herrmann, guys. That's what he's been doing. And sometimes he does really well, and then he tries to copy himself 15 times, and when you make a copy of a copy on a Xerox, it sounds like garbage. But the whole
movie... You're mixing your metaphors, but I understand.
I don't really know where I was going with that. But that music through the whole movie, It took me back. It made me... I had to remind myself a couple of times that between that and the clothing that she intentionally puts on to harken back to an older age, I had to be like, oh yeah, this movie was made in 2007 and not the 1970s, because they are really pulling off so many of those tropes really well. But yes, let's jump into this movie that you find once you start peeling back that wallpaper.
Okay, so the story goes like this. Young boy... deformed son of an awkward woman, very awkward woman. She goes to work at this home for children and brings her child. Those children reject this child because as fucked up as their lives are, they don't look like this kid.
Yeah.
And so they decide to play a prank on this kid where they go into a cave. They rip off the sack that he keeps over his face. And they run out and they just want to lure him out.
I can't believe this is the first time in this show and about this movie that we've talked about the creepy kid.
Yeah. Well, because that's that he's a red herring.
Yes.
He is communism. He is a red herring. It is literally, he is supposed to be the spooky thing that when you get to the end of this movie is not so spooky.
Well, and they do a really good job earlier in giving you reason to think there is something malevolent about this little kid ghost.
Right. And so he refuses to come out because he's so mortified. He's such a socially awkward kid. Tide comes in, he drowns. The mother of this child is distraught. Poisons the rest of the kids to get revenge because the cops won't do anything. The cops won't, prosecute.
They're just kids playing.
They're kids playing. They just grabbed the sack from his head. They didn't mean to kill him. So she poisons them. Their death is harrowing, and that is what we fucking hear in that seance, and that's just so fucking creepy. We're listening to five children die of poisoning.
Ooh.
And then this family shows up, moves into the house, and Simone goes out to the cave. And that's where he sees the little boy and the other kids.
Yeah.
And they're all out there because that's their punishment. Their punishment is they are banished to this place where they did this horrible thing. And she grew up with them. She knew all of them. So they want to come to the house. And so they ask the little boy, who mom thinks is just talking to his invisible friends, can we come to the house? Mm-hmm. And he asks her, and she goes, yeah, sure, your new friends can come. They've been invited into the house. She has transgressed. She has invited them into the house.
Vampires. They have to be invited.
So he goes and leaves the shells on the way there. And when she comes out that next day, she opens the door. All the shells are piled up there. The ghosts are in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when the real game begins. So they go and pick, they play the game with him. He wins the game. he makes his wish. What we know his wish is from what he said is that he wants to live in this house forever. He knows he's going to die. He wants to live with friends, but he wants to live with his mother, who is not his mother, but who may as well be.
Right, right.
He wants to live with her forever. That is her wish, his wish. He gets it.
Yeah.
He gets the wish. Now, her wish, as she says aloud, she just wants to live in this house with, as she says, 5 or 6 kids and take care of them.
Yeah.
That's what she wants. That's the perfect life. Her husband, not so much. He's a doctor, but he, you know, he loves her. He wants to oblige her, but this is not his dream.
Right. And by the way, the whole story about the kid with the bag on his head, did you, like I did, have a moment where you thought, this is kind of like the Victorian Jason Voorhees, where it's like a deformed kid with a murderous mother, gets picked on by a bunch of other kids, ends up drowning, he comes out with a sack on his head. I was like, I could easily have seen this being a Victorian Friday the 13th.
Except that because it's fairy tale and not, you know, slasher
movie. Oh, I'm totally
movie.
Joking.
Like, yeah, no, I get that. No, you're not wrong. And this is one of the things I think is great about Bayona is Bayona's films, he is so very good at repurposing old ideas and making them feel fresh again and making them feel like they're not ripped off. Like, you are not wrong. Like, everything you've just sold is the Jason Voorhees story. But what if Jason Voorhees existed in a fairy tale and there's a very beautiful, bittersweet ending?
What if Jason Voorhees was one of the Lost Boys? Is essentially what's going on here. And there's a great deal of Peter Pan imagery and references throughout the entire movie.
Because the mother is Wendy, and these dead children are the Lost Boys.
Because if you remember in Peter Pan, there is a moment where the Lost Boys, as much as they're enjoying their freedom, have this moment where they see Wendy as a mother figure, and that makes them pine for having someone to look after them.
And that's how Wendy becomes that, and that's what this movie is. Yeah. This is the movie about Wendy going off to live with the Lost Boys in the way that she doesn't in Peter Pan. It is an inverted Peter Pan. And when she plays the game, and she wins the game, she gets her wish.
Yeah.
And they both Simone and her, get her wish that they want to live in the house forever as spirits, where she shepherds and acts as the mistress, the lady of the house to all of these children that just need a mother.
Yeah. It turns out you should not make wishes if Rod Serling is your genie, because, yeah, they get what they want, but in that very, like, be careful what you wish for sort of way. And let's talk about this ending, because I remember, it's so crazy. I remember during this Q&A at Fantastic Fest 2007, Bayona described a theory that has stuck with me as I watch movies to this day. He said, in the mind of an audience member, there are always 3 endings to every film. There's the ending they want, the ending they think they want, and the ending they really want. And the idea is that the happy ending, where everybody kind of gets what they want, and it's, you know, no one dies and everyone's back where they were at the beginning of the movie, that's the one they want. The shocking ending is the one they think they want, and will, in fact, they'll be satisfied with that. But the complicated ending that effectively weaves all the narrative threads together and breaks, even if it completely breaks you apart, is the one that you didn't even allow yourself to entertain, but turns out the one that means the most to you at the end of the day. And I always thought that was a really smart thing that he said. And what I love about The Orphanage is you had no idea at the beginning of this movie how much you wanted The Orphanage to crush you. So this is definitely the ending that you really want, even if you didn't.
Well, and that's the thing, is what he's talking about is that great ending, because I disagree with him on 3 endings. I think there's only 2. I think there's the ending they want, the ending they really want. I don't think there's the shocking ending that they'll be fine with, because I don't necessarily feel that audiences will. I feel that the greatest, many of the greatest stories in history are telling you one story when you think they're telling you another. Mm-hmm. When you look at Casablanca, you think you're watching the story about a guy who's trying to find redemption through love. and that he is trying to get back that love that he lost. And really, Casablanca is about a guy getting his soul back.
Yeah.
And that the decision he makes at the end of the movie to send Ilsa off with Victor is a decision that he makes that saves his soul and puts him back where he was before we met him, turns him back into the revolutionary, turns him back into the good guy. When we met him, he wasn't really the revolutionary anymore. He was just this guy in the underground running a club in Paris, and he meets this girl and he thinks she's everything. But he, you know, at the end of the day, the great satisfying ending for us is the love of Rick's life flies off with her husband, and Rick walks off with a sleazy molester of a man as a new best friend, a guy who's turned a corner and finally, you know, come into his own with Claude Rains, and they walk off and it's like, Rick, this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. You know, and that's what this is. This is a movie. You think you're watching a ghost story. Mm-hmm. You think you're watching a story about a woman trying to find a little boy and trying to find out what is going on in the house, when really it's a woman trying to find her place in the universe where she belongs as a spirit tending to the tragic souls that were born to a shit life and went into an even worse death.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to say this too, just a little disclaimer. This was several years ago. I may be slightly misquoting Bayona. He may have only said two, but I feel like I remember three. But based on what I remember of his theory, I actually mapped this out for the orphanage. So the orphanage ending that I think the audience wants would be Tomas turns out to be a benevolent spirit, the kid with the bag on his head, Simone is found safe and sound. The end. You know, the actual
ending. The happily ever after is Tomas is a spirit fighting against the evil of his mother and is actually trying to help Simone against these evil children
that are
trapping Simone, and that it all works out for the best and he gets set free. No.
The orphanage ending the audience thinks they want, I believe, is that the parents are shockingly killed. Tomas adds Simone to his legion of murderous kid ghosts, much like the end of your movie, The Legend of Bagul Vance.
Boo.
I love that joke. I'm keeping it in. Editor's note, do not take that out.
We don't have any magical figure that comes in and goes, you know, Ethan.
You know, Ellison. You have a magical D'Onofrio. That's pretty similar to...
He's
right?
Not a magical... No, the magical D'Onofrio is in A Magnificent Seven.
He exists only in Skype, Cargill. He is a magical D'Onofrio.
I think we can all agree that a man has a right to take back his own belongings.
I believe that... It's like, what is that voice you're doing?
It's amazing is what it is.
I love the fact that the only person in Hollywood who can literally phone into a movie and not turn in a phoned-in performance is Benicio Del Toro, because all through Sinister, he's literally only exists in Skype, and he doesn't phone in his performance.
Yeah, you just said Benicio Del Toro, who's not
in Sinister. Oh, I'm sorry. Vincent D'Onofrio. What's at the bottom of this?
Delightful, delicious D'Onofrio.
Guillermo del Benicio. And then, of course, the orphanage.
I would not. Oh, could we get Benicio del Toro? That would be great.
That would have been a weird character.
Benicio del Toro is Deputy So and So. Are you kidding me?
who the fuck is this? Killed the family.
Who for real? Just be like, well, we both went to the same fucking movie for that. We both went 20 years back. Jesus, you guys got 20 years of career.
Yeah,
since
and
then.
We're still Unusual Suspects.
Usual Suspects.
Of course we are. Of course we are. God, what the fuck? But the ending the audience really wants is the ending that we get. It's not an easy pill to swallow, because it's a bittersweet finale that offers these characters all everything that they want, and also presents the idea that death is a happy ending, which is really difficult to reconcile as a happy ending.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, and that's why it's the strongest choice of all three. I mean, it's basically supernatural survivor guilt when you think about it, because this woman has, you know, once she finds out what happens to the kids, like, she was the only one that got adopted of this whole group, and then they were all, like, almost immediately after she was adopted, horrifically killed, and all she wants to do is she has the power to change the ending for somebody else. I mean, in this case, she literally, like, makes a sacrifice to give these orphans a better existence in the afterlife to make up for their tragic endings that happened after she left, which is fucking survivor's guilt. Yeah. I mean, she is straight up murdered by her maternal nature. It is fucking crazy. And it's such the perfect ending for this movie. And she ends up, you know, surrounded, you know, like Wendy with the Lost Boys, or, you know, it's a dead kids club.
Wow, way to plug your friend's short film in there.
Short film, Paul Gendersman, Peter Hall, dead kids club. No, it's a Burger King dead kids club. You can have it your way as long as your way doesn't involve a pulse. And yeah, that's the orphanage.
That brings such an elegantly beautiful fucking
God,
movie.
And it I broke down and I wept again. And I've seen this movie multiple times, and every time this ending gets
I'm looking forward to watching this back to back with When a Monster Calls.
Ooh.
Or A Monster Calls. Which one is it? I think it's just A Monster Calls.
I think it's just A Monster Calls. It's Liam Neeson like, "Hello, I don't know who you are, but I have a very particular set of monsters."
No. There's the one under the bed. Like, seriously, it's a magnificent fucking movie. Like, if you love The Orphanage, A Monster Calls comes out. I think they're giving it an Oscar push. I think it comes out like late December in some markets and then January everywhere else.
Nice.
Keep that on your radar when you hear about it. Sigourney Weaver's in it.
Very cool.
And Liam Neeson. And you're going to see the trailers, and the trailers look great, and it's going to feel very Del Toro-esque. But it is its own beautiful, wonderful thing. It was one of my favorites of Fantastic Fest, which you may recall me mentioning when we did did we only do that for patrons? Was that a patron thing?
I believe we only did that for patrons.
Yeah, so those patrons are like, "We know what you're talking about," and everyone else is like, "What the fuck is Cargill rambling about now? God damn it. What episode did I miss?" Monster Calls is just, it's so wonderful and is very much like this and is very much another Bayona fairy tale that by the time you get to the end of the movie becomes something very different in all the right ways. And it's not, and what I love about what he does is he doesn't pull the rug out from under you. He's the anti-Shyamalan.
Yes.
He's not like, "Oh, did that fuck you up? What did it change your perception?" It's like somebody going, "But the power was within you all along, but without it being cheesy."
Yeah.
Like, he's literally telling you this story that it makes you think it's one story, and then it's another story, and you're like, "Oh, your second story is so much better. That's awesome. I love this."
It also has one of the best immediately preceding cut to credits I have ever seen, which is that the husband now, like, right after... this mother's been taking these pills, which we assume are for her nerves or something. It turns out she's slowly killing herself so that she can be with her son. And then the next shot after that happens is the husband at the headstone, which is in front of the house, which beautifully not only has her name and Simone's name, because of what we find out happened to Simone, which is so amazingly interconnected, and everything just fits like a puzzle. It's so good. We kind of glossed over that, but there's some discovery to be mined here if you haven't already seen it and you're still listening to this. But after, not only on that headstone are her name and Simone's name, but the names of all the children from the orphanage that were murdered. And he goes into the house and he finds something of hers, and then the doors slightly open on their own, and he realizes that she's playing the game with him, and he just smiles. Credits. Oh my God. Oh, the goosebumps. All of the goosebumps ever. Love this movie. I cannot recommend this movie more highly. This is probably one of my favorite movies. Like,
really?
Period. Oh my God, period. Excellent. I will watch this any day of the week.
I would argue that this is one of the absolute... You know what? And here's the thing about this. This is one of the... probably one of the 10 best horror films of the millennium so far that ends up on the list, but ends up like in the high 30s or 40s.
It deserves higher than
you
that.
You know, where people are like, "Yeah, that's really good, but it's more mainstream. And I kind of want this list to be more about the really great stuff we saw at festivals that nobody gives a shit about." This is one of those movies that I think it is going to go down as a classic. I think it's going to be one of those that, in another 10 years, people are still going to be recommending, "Oh God, you need to go and watch The Orphanage. Like, check that fucking movie out. That movie's fucking great." And not just critics talking about obscure stuff. It's like, "What do you mean you haven't seen The Orphanage? Holy shit, that movie's so good." And it's a movie that invites you to rewatch it and invites you to rewatch it almost every year, as I do with my wife. So I'm a big fan. I absolutely adore this movie. I think it is a masterpiece. I do not use that lightly. That is not a, oh man, I fucking love this. You know, nobody else gets this, but it's like, no. This one's a genuine masterpiece. And Bayona is one of those Oscar caliber directors for a reason.
There are children who can see a hidden world.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which I
beer again,
no,
I assume.
No.
Really, actually, you broke.
Because this movie is about kids, it just felt wrong to make the junk food pairing a beer. It just felt a little like you don't recommend beer to minors, kind of a thing. So instead, I suggest making, like, you know, settling down in the evening with a nice bit of toast. And smear on the toast some Peter Pan peanut butter, because not only the peanut butter, the Peter Pan imagery and metaphor throughout this whole movie, but
and the fact that peanut butter toast is fucking awesome.
Yes, it is. But last week we talked about Britain and their spicy mustard that they think we can't handle. And
did you research it? Did you go and find out that their spicy mustard is, in fact, pretty fucking hot?
No. I have a big problem, as it turns out, still, with presumptuous food. And I feel like Peter Pan, I kept thinking about this brand, right? Why is it called Peter Pan? What in the story, what in J.M. Barrie's Peter Pan has any fucking thing to do with peanut butter, right? Can't think of anything. And then I thought, like, oh, wait a minute. Peter Pan is a character that is a boy that never grew up. So are they saying that if you're an adult eating peanut butter, that you are a child who never grew up? Because quite frankly, you can go fuck yourself, because peanut butter is every bit as much an adult food as it is for little kids. And as Cargill just said, peanut butter toast is a damn fine snack for anyone of any age. And I will not be patronized by my fucking snack food. Peter Pan on toast is this week's junk food pairing. I don't know why that got so hostile.
You went and set that all up, and there's no payoff. Like, you looked it up, and you could not find any connection between Peter Pan and peanut butter.
No. I did research for a long time trying to figure out why the fuck this brand of peanut butter is called Peter Pan.
I remember when I had free time.
I think it's just the alliteration. I think they're like, Peter Pan, peanut butter. Hey, oh, go. And it's like, no. No. Like, you can't just pick a random character that I assume is public domain at this point and just slap it on the front of your product and go, this is a thing that's connected to this other thing, but it's not. That's bad writing. That's bad writing, and that's not what you'll find in
the
orphanage.
Maybe it's the fact that peanut butter always connects you to your childhood, and it's not saying that you're not grown, you're a child if you eat it, but just the taste of peanut butter takes you back to being a child.
Look, and Marcel isn't that Proust. Warmth? Look, Marcel Proust. I will eat peanut butter at any age, and I don't give a damn what this product tries to tell me.
You're fucking licking out a tube of it right now. Like, you are in between. Like,
I poured my scotch into the peanut butter, and it is delicious.
Scotch-flavored peanut butter? That's
this week's junk food pairing.
Scotch-flavored
peanut butter.
There it goes. I've done it now.
Thank you so much for joining us, guys. Really hope you have enjoyed not only this episode, but the entire Festival of Fear. We will be back next week with a brand new film, maybe in a series, maybe a standalone. We don't even know yet.
We've already talked about what we're doing next.
Oh, we've talked about it, and I have forgotten at the bottom of this glass. So if you would like to follow us on Twitter, we're at Junk Food Cinema. You can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. If you really like us, please consider becoming a patron, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, or at least telling your friends to do so. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Fucking Google me. You can find me on at Massawyrm. That's MASSAWYRM.
I'm gonna buy you a t-shirt that says fucking Google me.
Yes, you will. Or you can find me on Facebook, facebook.com/Massawyrm.
Anytime I see a gorgeous woman, I just want to Google her. I just Google her immediately. I don't even know what it is. I don't even ask. I just Google her. You can find me.
They love it.
They love it.
When you're a star, they let you do that to
huge.
Them.
Huge.
You can Google them.
I'm huge on Google. You can find me on Twitter at junkfoods. No, you can find me at Bri Guy Salisbury, or my Facebook page is facebook.com/BrianSalisburyCritic. And I just want to end this show by reiterating once again that Peter Pan peanut butter, you have got some explaining to do.